So anyway, I'd love to thank the board for inviting me. I'm excited to be here today and talking to all of you. And what I want to share with you is, first of all, my 12th step that happened first before I knew anything about any of this, and then my path through the years to the point where I became a researcher at the University of Connecticut, looking at the after effects of spiritual awakenings. For 6 years, I studied the after effects, and I want to share that with you today. And at the same time, the discovery of how child abuse is really, really connected to spiritual awakening experiences. So stick with me as I tell you the story, and through the story, the whole research will unwind. I grew up in a home where we were very isolated from other people. We were a crazy family. We did not look good. And my mother was addicted to all kinds of prescription drugs. My father had to look the other way and pretty much walked out when the abuse was happening. But it was a childhood that, by the time I got out of the house at 18, I had to numb out to. It was my memories of the abuse was somewhere like being in a cellar somewhere behind the stairs with a dim light. I knew those memories were there, but I couldn't see them and I didn't want to. And within a short amount of time after leaving, I got married and had 3 wonderful kids and all of a sudden had the home of my dreams and, you know, my own car and we had an airplane and a swimming pool and you name it. We really looked good on the outside. On the inside, I can tell you that almost every day I was dying a little bit more, that there was just something missing so terribly. And that went on until I was, 32? No, actually 30 is when I injured my back. And the doctors told me, yes, you have scoliosis and you have a spondylolisthesis in your spine. And from a fall that I had taken, I had like whiplashed my lower spine and had an injury. So for the next 2 years, they treated me conservatively. And in the early 70s, that meant a lot of Valium as a muscle relaxant and started me with a little painkiller. And by the time I had my surgery, I was taking Percocet. And 4 hospitalizations where they did traction. This went on for 2 years. And at that point, I realized I wasn't being a mother to my kids. I wasn't being a wife to my husband. I was a chronic pain patient. And finally, they decided that what I might really need is a spinal fusion operation. Well, a spinal fusion operation, they're not doing them like they used to do them back then. It was heavy, heavy, heavy physical trauma. And what they did was they put me in a body cast first for a month. This was from my armpits down to my knees, with the idea that if that cast, which weighed 30 pounds, immobilized my spine to the point where my pain was gone, then the fusion, which was really like the cast on the inside, would stop the pain. So I wore the cast for a month and dreaded the idea that I was going to be put back into another cast, exactly like this one, for at least 6 weeks after surgery. But I went along with it because when I was in the first cast, I was off all the pain pills, I was off the Valium, I was off of everything. I felt really good again. So they took me back in for the 5th time, and I just remember pre-surgery, they wheeled this really weird-looking bed into my room. It looked like a Ferris wheel for one. There were 2 big chrome hoops, and then there was a stretcher suspended in the middle. And they told me that I was going to live in that bed for a month. Next day, I had the surgery. Woke up probably the day after that. Time really got lost in all of this. I woke up in this awesome bed. And it didn't bother me at all. I was out of pain because obviously I was on painkillers again. And I lived in that bed for almost a month where I couldn't move. The bed moved me. 3 times a day they would come in and put several pillows over me and another stretcher like the one I was lying on. And then they would strap it in and they would rotate me up and over. And I would lie like that for maybe 20 minutes to a half hour. And that was to drain my lungs and air out my back so I wouldn't get bed sores and so I wouldn't get pneumonia. About 3 days after surgery, they brought in a portable respirator and hooked me up to it. It's interesting that later I became a respiratory therapist. I'll tie that in. At the time, I had no medical training at all. But they wheeled in this little portable ventilator, And this young man told me what they were going to do. He was going to hook me up to it and was going to give me deep breaths for about 15 or 20 minutes to expand my lungs because they claimed I wasn't taking deep enough breaths. So he hooked me up and watched the machine for a couple minutes and left, which you never, ever, ever do. And they had a mouthpiece inside my mouth between my gums and my teeth. Okay. So that I couldn't push it out. And somewhere in the breathing in and the breathing out, the machine was faulty and didn't reverse. And I was trapped with this air flowing in, and I just remember feeling the sensation and passing out. I woke up later with this huge belly, and the first thing I thought of was, oh, I'm having another baby. Good old morphine. But I could feel I had two big incisions in my back. I could feel those incisions spreading. They were being pulled apart. So I started calling, and then I started screaming, and then I became hysterical, and people started rushing in, just like you see on TV, you know, pushing carts and machinery and hooking me up to everything. And I was screaming, leave me alone, let me die. And I really did want to die at that point. I mean, now that I know what I know about being an adult child of a dysfunctional family, I really didn't have what I needed to go on living, especially the part about not being able to be a mother to my children anymore. So I remember wanting to die. It was like, everybody get away from me and let me go. Now, I have to tell you that I was an atheist. I remember as a little girl praying. I remember asking God when I was a little girl to help my mother, to do something for her to change, and that never happened. So that by the time I became an adult, I didn't believe in anything anymore. So being an atheist, I just assumed I would be in oblivion, that I would be gone, and that's what I wanted. And I blacked out, and when I woke up, I was out in the hallway. And I thought, if they catch me out here, I'm going to be in trouble because I'm supposed to be in that bed. You know? I better get back in the room, you know, good adult child. I'm going to get back in my body. But I didn't know I was out of my body yet. I really thought this was me and I was out in the hall. But as I moved back into the room, there was a PA speaker above my doorway up at the ceiling, which had to be at least 10 feet. And I was looking into that speaker. So as I was looking into that speaker, that's when I realized something is wrong. I moved back into the room, and there was my body lying in the circle bed. And I remember chuckling, thinking, she looks really funny with that tape wrapped around her nose. They had an NG tube down my throat, and they had tape there, and that's all I thought of was, boy, does she look funny? It wasn't me. The me that was up at the ceiling looking down was very peaceful. I was more peaceful than I had ever been in this lifetime. It was just a feeling of everything is okay. And the next thing I knew, I was moving through darkness. Now later, when I met the other researchers, the word tunnel came up. At the time, I couldn't explain this as a tunnel, but I think tunnel in the English language is the closest word. I was moving through this tunnel. And somewhere in the tunnel came my grandmother. Now my grandmother had been dead for 14 years, and I had never once imagined that she was existing beyond her death. My grandmother was there, and my grandmother wrapped herself around me, and she held me, and I remember feeling this lush warmth, just moving into, she had a huge, huge chest, just moving into all this love like it used to be when she would hug me as a child. Now, at that moment, and I couldn't explain this for the longest time till I met Charlie, but at that moment, when she put her arms around me and held me, there was a lifting of, the only words are toxic pain. It was like I had this huge bundle of toxic pain that I carried somewhere on my shoulders my whole life. That was my wounding. That was my false self. That was my ego. That was the voice of the abuser's values. Whatever you want to call it, as she hugged me, that lifted. And together, we re-experienced the 19 years we were together on this planet. But I didn't just experience it again from my point of view. I was her too. I could see through her eyes and feel it from her heart how much she had loved me. And I know she could feel what I was feeling towards her. And we went through the whole 19 years. Now, I'm 32 at this time, but I want to tell you that every single memory was as vivid as me standing here in front of you now. My favorite example is I'm about 3 or 4 years old. Now, I don't think I had any memory of this before I had my near-death experience. But I am 3 or 4 years old. I am in her kitchen. It is Friday. It is going to be the Sabbath pretty soon, and we're cooking a Sabbath dinner. We're cooking. I'm watching her cook. She's dropping this mixture into this huge boiling pot, and I asked her if I could do it, and she pulled a chair over for me, and I can still feel her wrapping her arms around me to protect me, and working with my hands, she put a little mixture in my hand, and I'd roll it around and then drop it in the boiling water, and I can still smell it. I mean, every sense comes back when we're having a life review. We were making gefilte fish. No, not matzo balls. Gefilte fish. I can smell the fish. That's how I know it's not matzo balls. I could smell the fish. And when we were all through, she ran and got a lemon and cut it in half, and then I can still feel her rubbing my little hands with lemon. She had so much love in her. Anyway, then she looked at me and she said, "Don't move. Bubby will be right back." And she ran and she got her brush, and she came back, and nobody had ever touched my hair. She made like sausage curls like Shirley Temple used to have, and then she carried me over to the mirror and she showed me. That's how vivid the memories were. And as we got through to her dying, I moved away from her and continued moving through the tunnel. And I wanted to keep going, and the next thing I knew, it was morning. I was back in my body, back in the circle bed with all these tubes and bottles and pumps and noise, and pretty awesome. A week later, it happened again. Now, I was off the critical list, and I wasn't being given morphine. I went back into my medical records years later, and at that point, I was on very, very little. I was on no narcotics. I was just on a muscle relaxant. But this is what happened again. I had been turned over onto my face, and they had forgotten about me. Nobody was coming back. And I started calling, and then I started screaming. Oh, the reason why they couldn't hear me when I was calling was since that first experience, my hearing became so acute. It's so sensitive. And I find a lot of people who have had spiritual experiences, spiritual awakenings, I'm getting nodding heads, all of our senses become so heightened that things like keeping the door closed so we don't hear loud noises. So I had them keeping the door closed. I was on my tummy. They had pinned the button on my sheet like they did every time to hit the call button, and it had fallen away. So I couldn't get anybody to come back for me. So I started calling, then I started screaming, then I became hysterical. And as I became hysterical, now this time I was conscious when I left my body. I watched it happen. It's as though my body is down here in the circle bed crying in a bubble. And I looked out into the darkness and I saw myself at about a year old, face down in my crib, crying just as hard. And I looked back and forth about 3 times, and then I just didn't care anymore. I didn't want any part of her. And as I started to move towards the baby in the bubble, that toxic pain, which obviously had come back as soon as I came back before, that toxic pain lifted again. It was gone. I was me. I was what Charlie calls your child within. It's what Ken Ring, one of the researchers that I met up with later, called the core of who we are. That lifted. I became the real me again, and at the same time, I felt this energy wrapping itself around me and moving into me, and we became one. Now, you can imagine how this atheist came back. Try and explain that. But this energy that years later, I could call God. At first, when I saw the movie Star Wars, I was calling it the Force. And a lot of us do a lot of reading about quantum physics trying to figure this out, but it's an energy. I didn't see an old man with a long white beard who sits in judgment of us. I felt this incredible energy that was pure love wrap itself around me, and we watched my life again. From the age of about a year to the age of 32, I went through all the abuse again, not just from my mother, but my brother too, and my father's neglect. But I felt it from their point of view too, and I have to tell you that there wasn't the pain that there was the original living through it, because this energy holding me was letting me know everything was okay. And as I became an adult and I got married and I had my children, the realization was happening that I was going to wind up like my mother if I didn't do something. You know, here I was on drugs in the hospital, feeling a lot of pain. And at the same time, through this whole 32 years, I could hear my voice going, "No wonder. No wonder." And those no wonders to me mean, no wonder you are the way you are. Look what was done to you. If that was done to anybody, they would wind up being just the way you are. But we have choices now. We don't have to continue on this path. So it was like I not only had this wonderful, amazing view, I also had a partner now. I knew there was this higher power. And then I was back. But I wasn't back in my body. I was behind the nurse's station. And we were able to go back into the medical records later and find this. I was in a laundry room behind the nurse's station, and I was looking into a window, seeing the pillows tossing. When they stripped the bed after they found me, they had the pillows in there. It was my dirty linen. And I could hear them talking about my case, and I could hear them saying that when my day nurse found me, she was so upset they had to send her home early. And they were lying to me that the orthopedist had told them in the record that nobody could tell me the truth, and the truth was I was going to be in that body cast for 6 months, not 6 weeks. Then I was back in my body. And two nurses came in, and I said to them, please call my day nurse and tell her I'm okay, tell her I'm not angry with her. And I said, and you got to tell me the truth. I know I'm going to be in the body cast for 6 months, not 6 weeks. I was sedated. That was how they took that in, yeah. And as you all know, that bundle of toxic pain was right back where, you know, it was used to being on my shoulders. About 3 months into the body cast, I insisted on seeing a psychiatrist because I wanted to go over what had happened. I hadn't told anybody. For those of us that had these experiences spontaneously, and I'll go into the other triggers in a few minutes, but for those of us that weren't looking for it, when it hits us like a 2x4. We have no idea what's coming. And if you're an atheist like me, it's really a shock. So it was too personal to share with my significant others. But about 3 months into the body cast, I got my brother to take me to a psychiatrist. I remember waddling in on the walker. And he had my medical records, and they were like this high. And he said to me, Barbara, if I had been through what you've been through, I would need to see a psychiatrist too. And I thought, oh, this guy's going to understand. Well, this was back in the mid-70s. About 5 sessions in, I trusted him enough to tell him what I just told you. And he wrote me a prescription for antidepressants. He told me I was depressed. He told me to go home and be a good girl for the rest of the time I was in the body cast to behave. And once I got out and once I went through physical therapy, that if I wanted to, he would take me in analysis. I didn't go back. What I did when I came home was I flushed all of the drugs they had given me down the toilet. I just didn't want to take anything anymore. I wanted to clear my head. And about 6 months after I got out of the body cast, I volunteered at the hospital where I had been. And I wound up, thank you, I wound up in the emergency room working there. And I remember the first day I worked in the emergency room wearing my pinafore and the whole thing. I had such a headache. I was so excited about getting out there and helping other people or just doing something good. And midway through the day, they brought in an old woman who it was obvious to me was dying. And she was shivering. And she was just laying in a gurney shivering. And one of the docs said to me, go into wherever and there's a warmer. Take out a couple blankets and put them on her. It looked like a refrigerator. I opened it up. There were warm blankets. I took 2 warm blankets out, started spreading them over her, and noticed that my headache was draining out of my arms through my hands, and this woman's coloring was getting better. And she said to me, my pain medication is working. I sat down and held her hand for I don't know how long, and they just tiptoed around me. Nobody asked me to do anything anymore. Within a few months, they knew that I was the one that they could send if somebody was dying to sit with. And that became my volunteer work at the hospital. I would go and sit with people that were dying. Many of us who have had near-death experiences go on to some kind of hospice work. Well, a couple years into that, and I decided it was time to get a kind of education where I could do this for a living. So that's when I became a respiratory therapist. And it was interesting because this was in the late 70s, and I started writing for journals while I was still a student on the emotional needs of critical care patients. Nobody had talked about this yet, and it suddenly became the thing to be reporting on at nursing and respiratory therapy conferences. So I started getting invited to come and speak about what these people really need besides paralyzing them and giving them a tranquilizer. They're still experiencing all kinds of emotional pain in ICU and in the emergency room. And pretty soon after that, I met Kenneth Ring. I don't know if any of you are familiar with his work, but he's written several definitive books on the near-death experience. I met him. I told him my story. He asked me to come up to the University of Connecticut to be interviewed for a book he was coming out with called Heading Toward Omega. And what he was doing is he was looking at spiritual awakenings as a very normal process that Western medicine doesn't know about, but Eastern medicine does, and that there's an energy arousal. When we connect spiritually with a higher power, we become energized. And in the East, they use acupuncture, acupressure, all these different methods to work with the energy, and we here in the West don't know anything about it. So that was my first research, and then I got hired to go to the University of Connecticut and work in the psych department. And my first research was on suicidal ideation, people who are attempting suicide. And the most exciting part about that is that I got to go into the emergency room when they were being brought in and interview them firsthand, just as they were either still in it or coming out of it. And then we kept an eye on these people for the next year. They would come in at least once a month and I'd interview them. And there were already two research projects that were done on this, but they were done retrospective. They were done years later where they interviewed the people. We were doing it firsthand. We came up with the same conclusion, that people that attempt suicide and have some kind of spiritual experience during it, and this I found out later, this is the same thing for when we've bottomed out. You know, we don't have to try to kill ourselves. We can just want to kill ourselves, and we've just lost everything, and we totally bottomed out. These experiences happen. And the reason why people told me they don't attempt again after having this kind of an experience, two reasons. One is they were given the knowledge that no matter how many times they try to leave, they're going to be sent back because they have to face their problems. And the other reason that was given, which is sort of the same, is that they realize that there's a higher wisdom going on. There's a higher, call it a mystery, call it God, call it whatever you want to call it. There's something higher going on, and it makes their problems get much smaller when they get that much, much bigger picture. Okay, I'm at the university about 3 years already, and I am asking my colleagues to please look at child abuse. We were looking at all different ways to tie in why some people have these experiences and why some people don't. And my colleagues really didn't want to. You know, they want to research these wonderful experiences that they were claiming healed us instantly. And I kept telling them, I was not healed instantly. It was a wonderful experience. I feel connected now. But I still had that load of toxic pain. It's not gone. No, you've been healed. That was how they wanted to do it. I finally convinced them to put on one of our instruments that went out to over 500 subjects if they had any memories of child abuse. 58% came back with, oh yeah. And the term that was used was unpredictable violence. Did you live your childhood with unpredictable violence? And 58%, which is very, very high in the field of research, who had a spiritual awakening experience, maybe not close to death, but a 12th step, had it, and also had child abuse. Well, naturally, I was really excited and wanted to move into that tangent. As far as we got in the research was, the only thing we could find that was different about people who had near-death experiences and had child abuse was something called the absorption scale. When it comes to being absorbed, we are not like the average. We are not like the control group. We become so absorbed in whatever we're doing that we lose track of what's going on around us. And that's wonderful for creativity. That's wonderful for poetry, for music, for anything in the creative field. It's wonderful if you want to be a child again, if you want to be childlike like last night, to be absorbed, to become absorbed in something like that. So we looked at that, and I wanted to keep going. What I wanted to do was figure out, well, how do we heal? And that's when Charlie called me and invited me to this ACA conference. Does everybody know what synchronicity is? Yeah. Is there anybody that doesn't know what synchronicity is? Okay, meaningful coincidences. So many things start happening that line you up to aim you some way. And it's way above the average of this happening. It's like there's something bigger going on that's... Can you imagine, just as I want to start investigating how to help people that have been abused as kids, and my colleagues say no, Charlie calls me and invites me to an ACA conference. And he had sent me his book, Healing the Child Within, years before, and I had it sitting up on my shelf, but I hadn't read it. So I thought, well, before I go to this conference and before I have dinner with this man, I better read Healing the Child Within. I was so excited to read a book where the work had already been done. I didn't know the work had been done. And obviously when I went and heard him talk, I realized that this was something I wanted to bring back to. That we called ourselves near-death studies, and then it became the near-death movement. Well, I tried to bring it back. But I came into something that I'm going to explain in a few minutes called spiritual bypass, also known as high-level denial or premature transcendence. But first, let me just go over a couple triggers with you, because I know that some of you, if not a lot of you, have had a spiritual awakening, and it wasn't close to death. Here's some of the other ways I've heard, and I bet you can tell me some more. Childbirth. I talked at an American Holistic Medical Association conference years ago, and I had several women, OBGYNs, come up to me and say, yeah, I had that experience when I delivered my first child or my second child or whatever. I was up near the ceiling, and usually the ones that have it in childbirth, if they have a deceased mother or grandmother, is there with them watching the delivery. And it's obviously ecstatic. They tell me they don't need pain medication. They're just out of their body watching. You know, when transcendental meditation came to this country, within like 3 years, the psych emergency rooms were reporting a big, big rise in people coming in that thought they were psychotic, who had learned how to meditate, because they weren't prepared for what they were going to see. And if you want to, if you're meditators, I'll go into that in a little while. Intense prayer. I've had one priest and several nuns tell me that during their ordinations, they were lifted out of their bodies and went into the light. And I've had other people just tell me that spontaneously, when they've been praying, they had light experiences. Experiencing the death of a loved one. Now, even if I had never had a near-death experience, just helping my father die would have awakened me to this level. He died very quickly. I flew down there. He was in a coma. This was in Florida. They told me he would not come out of the coma. I went into the room, and I started talking to him and playing with his forehead and his hair. And within a half hour, his eyes were open, and he was talking to me. Within a couple of hours, my three kids had gotten there, and he wanted a corned beef sandwich. You talk about communion. You know, we sat on his bed with him and shared memories and ate corned beef sandwiches. And then within an hour, I had him in hospice. And about 11 o'clock at night, I left. I didn't want to, but my mother and my brother wanted to go back and sleep. I went back to my parents' apartment. I was lying on their sofa in the living room, and at exactly 3:30 in the morning, because I looked at the clock, I heard some breathing. And then the breathing stopped. And within 2 minutes, the phone rang. It was the hospice. My father died. And I knew right away. I couldn't be there with him, so he was coming to me to take his last breath. Can you imagine if I had been an atheist then and that happened? And I hear these stories over and over and over again. When I've lectured at hospice, they're telling me all the time about the spiritual experiences they have as volunteers. People that are dying, their physical energy is dying, but that's generating more energy into their spiritual body. So as they're leaving, if we're willing and open, we can be entrained into their experience as they're going. You know, at least the peace, the incredible peace. Sometimes there's a lot of laughter because they're cracking jokes if we're open to it. And in fact, it's in my book, Spiritual Awakenings. I have some stories and I have a chapter on that one. Let's see what else. Withdrawal from chemical dependence. Bill W. is a perfect example. He had a light experience during detox. Bottoming out from overwhelming loss. Ken Ring asked me to include this one. An alien encounter. And that could be angels. It doesn't have to be a UFO. We're talking angels. I was speaking at a Catholic church in Connecticut when I was up there working. And somebody came up to me during the coffee break and said, has anybody ever told you about seeing an angel as an adult? And I said, yeah. And about three more people came up and asked. So when I came back, when the break was over, I said, you know, four people during the break have told me about seeing angels as adults. Can I see a show of hands? Is there anybody else who's seen an angel? Between a third and, yeah, I'm getting some hands here. Who's seen angels here? Let's just move from the church over here. Okay, hold up your hands, look around the room. You're not the only one. Usually in my audiences, I get about a third to a half of the audience has, as an adult, seen some kind of being that was not of this reality. Spontaneously in nature. I mean, any of these wilderness journeys that we can pay to go on. While reading spiritual literature or hearing a spiritual talk in a big dream that's remembered for life. I had a woman that was 97 years old, who wrote me after seeing an article about us in Red Book. And she said, oh, yeah, I had that experience when I was 17, so it was 80 years earlier. And she said, and that experience has ruled my life. What I learned, the values that I learned in just being with that energy, has for 80 years ruled my life, but it was only a dream. I had to call her. I called her up, and I said, could you tell me your experience? So she did. She told me over the phone, and I said to her, that's as valid as any spiritual experience I've ever heard. I said, please don't say it's only a dream. And she said, okay. Meanwhile, she was living proof. Breath and body work. You know, I'm also a body worker as well as a respiratory therapist, and now I'm doing group and individual therapy, but sometimes we need energy work or energy releases during our healing. And I would just suggest to some of you that haven't tried it to try it, because the way the energy body works, you can use acupuncture or you can use any kind of energy work as long as it's a good therapist that you trust. But we have blocks in our energy, and if they're removed, we're going to stay healthier. And then my favorite way, actually two ways, gradually through synchronicities or through 12-step work. With 12-step work, you know eventually, if you haven't had one yet, you're going to have a spiritual awakening and you're going to be prepared for it. There were too many people in the 60s and 70s who had these experiences spontaneously and wound up in psych hospitals because they weren't prepared. Their experiences weren't any different than ours, except that they weren't told what was happening to them, and when they tried to tell in an emergency room, they were immediately listed as psychotic and sent away somewhere and put on drugs. And drugs is the worst thing in the world that we can do for ourselves, for our physical health and our spiritual health when we're awakening. Because, see, before we have these awakenings, before ACA work, people who haven't gotten to or understand yet the concepts of ACA, to me, are asleep. And when we start to do this kind of work, we're waking up. And as we're waking up to the idea that we're a whole human being. We're not just physical. Of course we're emotional. Unfortunately, the voice of our abuser's values get in our way, and that's what we're fighting to get rid of, to wake up from. And when we wake up from that, our reality, I think a lot of you know this already, reality is so much bigger than what it was before. You know, and this brain is what I call a reducing valve, In respiratory therapy, before we could plug our oxygen tubes into the wall, we used to push in these great big green tanks of oxygen. 2,200 pounds of pressure a square inch. Yet when we hooked it up to the patient, when we put the tube in and hooked it up to them, they were just getting a gentle little stream. Well, how did that happen? It's the reducing valve on the top of the tank takes that pressure, that 2,200 pounds of pressure, and reduces it down to that gentle stream. Well, our brain does the same thing. It's our reducing valve. All of reality, as it is right now, is like 2,200 pounds per square inch. We can't take it all in. We have this reducing valve that brings it down. When we're still suffering, when we still had that huge bundle of toxic pain from our childhood, that stream is so small. It's sort of like what our abusers would let us know, and not much more. But as we heal, the stream gets stronger. It gets bigger. Reality becomes amazing. And when we get to that point, we're awake. We're not asleep anymore. And that's what we're dealing with the after effects, because some people don't want to be awake. They want to go back to sleep. But mainly when we wake up spiritually, we move away from materialism and we move more towards altruism. We want to start helping. A lot of us talk about selfless service. The extreme of that is we had a couple near-death experiencers who were taken to court by their family because they were giving everything away. A perfect example of that is Ebenezer Scrooge. Remember when he comes out of it and he throws the money out to the kid and says, go get the biggest goose you can find in the window at the butcher? That's what happens if it happens spontaneously and we don't know what a spiritual experience is. So let me just check my notes for 1 minute to see where I'm going here with this. Spiritual bypass. I have had a spiritual experience and I am healed. I don't need therapy. I don't need ACA. I don't need anything. But all of you have got to do what I say. Right? Right? Because I'm the boss now because I've been with God. This is what we deal with. Now, when I brought this idea of unpredictable violence back to my colleagues, and let's work on this because people need to heal, I kept hearing, no, no, they're healed. And then we had support groups, and I go into the support groups, and I try to introduce this whole idea. And it was interesting. Some of the women that were there in the support groups who had had out-of-body experiences and had not revealed how until I brought this subject up started revealing that they were incested as a child and they would leave their bodies. So I started asking around some more, and I was hearing more and more about child sexual abuse and leaving our bodies. And they were afraid to talk about it. Can you imagine they were afraid to talk about it in our support groups? Because we were standing there and saying, well, we nearly died. But nearly dying isn't the only way we leave our body. And once we've left our body and come back to it, the realization that we exist without our bodies wakes us up. I know I was a spirit before I was born. I know now I'm this spirit in this body trying to figure out what being human is. And I know that when I die, my body will die, but I will continue existing. And for anybody that's had an out-of-body experience while they've been abused, they know that too. And I personally experienced that many times as a child. I would be in my bed crying, and I would wind up in what I now call a tunnel. I would leave. It was too painful to be here. But I existed without my body. And this is what I mean by waking up. So I couldn't quite figure out what was going on, and then Charlie and I started talking about spiritual bypass. And I'm going to try the overhead now for the first time and explain spiritual bypass. Have any of you learned about spiritual bypass yet? Do you know what I'm talking about? Will you put this on for me? Where is it? I can't find it. Here it is. These are the stages of recovery, and I have them in my books, and Charlie has this in his. Before recovery starts, let's say the person is chemically dependent, or a diabetic, can be physical illness, or any kind of illness or disorder that's stopping us from living a normal life. This is stage zero. Recovery hasn't started yet. Then we go and we get help for our stage zero disorder. We join AA. We go and we dry out. We start taking insulin. We do. This could be chronic pain patient. Anybody goes into a stage zero disorder, full recovery program for that basic illness. And usually that's 6 months to 3 years. Now, underlying this act of illness is a wounding. Nobody in the medical field is addressing that wounding. How many times have I worked in the emergency room where somebody came in that was obviously drunk, and it was never addressed? Because maybe the doctor working in the emergency room that day was an alcoholic, yeah. So there was no way we were going to ask, right? But beyond them being an alcoholic or whatever else it is, if somebody would have only asked us, were you abused as a child?
that might have something to do with the illness that we've got going on right now. It isn't that that wounding from our childhood created the illness, but it's underlying it, and it won't let us heal from it. It's like this chronic low-grade fever that keeps our immune system down. All right? So we've recovered from that, but we still have the wounding. And the next thing that hits our body is going to come on, and we get sick, and we get sick, and we get sick. And we stay between 0 and 1, just addressing the next illness that comes along. What I'm proposing here and what Charlie talks about is stage 2 recovery, where we look at our past trauma. We look at our childhood trauma, and we do our ACA work, and we do individual, where we do group therapy, and we read books, and we go to all the 12-step programs that we fit into, or we think we fit into. And eventually, we have a spiritual awakening. And that's when we get to experience stage 3 recovery, which is spiritual. It's all spiritual. Even when we're down in 0, it's spiritual. But as we do our trauma recovery, as we do our ACA work, we can feel that connection more and more. It becomes more obvious. Well, what I'm alluding to here with the spiritual bypass is that people that have a spiritual awakening, either in 0 or 1, don't want to do their work in stage 2. They don't want to do their ACA work. I have been healed. And they jump up to 3. And they hang out. How many times have you met somebody that's carrying their Bible? I don't need any of this stuff. I've been healed. I've got my Bible, and I'm going to quote you a verse to show you that I'm healed. The problem with that is we're talking about spirituality here that's a head trip. We're doing it from our intellect. It's not from our heart. It's from our head. And we can't hold on to it because it's too hot to hold on to. So they'll keep coming back down until they finally figure out that this is what they need to do. We need to heal psychologically and emotionally before we can float around. And part of this also is that we learn to stay grounded. You know, in the beginning, what I heard was a lot of, spiritual materialism. I am more psychic than you are. You know? No grounding at all. Like, hey, you know, we need to have our feet on the ground. We can hook up, but we need to be here too. And at the same time, we need to extend the other hand to our fellow human beings, not be way up at the top doing woo-woo stuff all the time. The NDE people did not want to hear this. I was not real popular after this at the talks. I think I gave one more talk at one more conference. Because they're going their way, I'm going my way. I bless them where they're at, but this to me is a lot more real. This is a lot more grounded. This is healing, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, that's just my opinion. Okay, and I have one more overhead, and then I'm going to go to questions and answers. This chapter is called Who Am I? The Map of the Mind. When we were born like an acorn in an oak tree. How much longer?
45 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Right here, just picture ourselves for a minute, our true self, who we really are, a child within. When we're born like an acorn in an oak tree, okay, the acorn falls. Inside that little tiny thing is the whole plan for this gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous tree to emerge. And that's us. We're born innocent children of God. And if we're given everything we need, the love, the caring, the nurturing, the mirroring, you name it, if we're given everything we need, we're going to grow up to be our true self. We're going to grow up to be our child within. We're going to grow up to be who we were meant to be. Unfortunately, we didn't get any of that. So we had to invent a false self. We had to invent this ego that ran our life. And, it, you know, for what we needed at the time, the ego or the false self was it. We needed it, and our child, as Charlie writes about, went into hiding. Now, we get into ACA recovery or whatever path we choose, and we start to heal this false self, which, as we all know, is quite a struggle because there's that voice of the abuser's values again. And I want you to know that when I read the ACA Big Book,
I think they handle the whole idea of the voice of the abuser's values so well, because, you know, I've been fighting with this voice for a long, long, long time, and it's taken forever and a lot of meditation and a lot of therapy to get that voice to quiet down. But guess what happens when it quiets down? When we get back into our heart. It's not a head trip. It's our heart, because we've worked really hard on this. We start to feel our higher self. There's a part of us in a different dimension, but hanging around, that wants so much to be a part of our life. Call it your guardian angel. Call it Christ consciousness. It has a million different names. There's a part of us that wants to hook up. And this is when the 12th step happens. When we start to feel we're not alone in this, we definitely have a partner, whatever you want to call it. There's a higher part of us. And that higher part of us hooks up to higher power. I think that if we tried to hook up to higher power, it would be just way too much for us, just like the reducing valve. We need a middleman. And the middleman doesn't have to be religion. It could be. But in order for us to do this experientially, in order for us to do this from our heart, this is the trio that we become. And Charlie named it the sacred person. We become a sacred person, and that's when we absorb our 12th step. This is who we are. And it's a much better way to live on this planet. Everything seems to settle down. There's a bigger meaning. There's something bigger going on. And even though the news on TV is trying to tell us how awful it is, we know deep in our hearts that that's just the media trying to keep us asleep. You know, the media wants us to believe that our serenity will come from our next purchase and buy their product, right? So as we're getting to our 12th step, we turn off that TV because it's just a bunch of static. And this is what it's really all about. Now, for those people that are doing a spiritual bypass, they don't know about their higher self. They don't know about their true self or their false self. They just want to come up here and say, well, this is where I'm at all the time, and carry their Bible. And I'm not putting down religion. I understand religion. It's wonderful to do it as a group. But the problems that I've had with religion over the years doing this research is that religion wants you to worship it. Religion used to be the bridge that would take us to it. Only now religion wants to be it. Any religion that says it's it doesn't have any spirituality in it. Spirituality is me and the God of my understanding, higher power, whatever you want to call it, in communion together. And nobody else can tell me about that relationship. I don't need to hear it from anybody else. I'm feeling it within my heart. And religion, see, we take away religion's power when we know that. And the media's in on it too, and sometimes I think the government's in on it, keeping us asleep. And for sure, the pharmaceutical industry is in on it, right? Pop a pill and don't do anything else. Just take our pill. Yeah. Right, not a generic, definitely. Listen, when the generic happens, when they lose their whatever to be exclusive, they'll come up with a new drug that's better than the old one. Okay. So let me see if I'm finished here, and then I can turn it over. Oh, no, I'm going to do a guided imagery with you all because this is a workshop. Are you all in the mood for a guided imagery first thing in the morning? Okay. No spiritual bypass in this guided imagery. Okay, what I'm going to do is this is going to take like 10 minutes, and then I'm going to open it up to questions and answers. Pardon? Turn the overhead off. Yeah, anybody that would like to lie down on the floor, please go ahead. If you have anything binding, you know, around your waist, if your belt's tight or something, loosen it up. We're all family here. Just get relaxed. Now, I just want to tell you that I'm going to ask you to close your eyes, but if you're not comfortable closing your eyes, don't. And if you want to open your eyes midway through, please do.
What's the session that you're calling? What's the portion that you're calling?
A guided imagery. Guided imagery, and I'm going to be talking most of the time. It's not going to be very quiet. This isn't like meditation. This is more of, well, I'll tell you what this is, okay, before I start. As a speaker over the years doing a lot of inspirational talks, I have talked with other inspirational speakers and we've compared notes, and what we say is that when we're giving a talk like this, sometimes we can see people's individual energy fields. Okay, call it an aura, whatever you want to call it. Some of us can see that. And as the talk goes on, we see everybody's energy fields melding together and we've all become like one energy field. And when we build a field like this, it's very powerful. And what I'm going to have us do today is send love out. We're going to breathe in love from higher power, and then we're going to breathe it out to all the scorched land in Southern California. And then we're going to breathe it out to the world. So it's a very sweet guided imagery, obviously, a very loving one. And what I want to tell you is when it's over, I'm going to ask everybody not to clap. Because when we clap, it breaks the energy fields back to individuals. And this is the magic of recovery. We're spending the weekend talking about the magic. This is the real magic, when people can feel unity with each other, when an ACA gathering happens or any kind of gathering that's for healing. There's something magical that happens. Call it synchronicity, call it entrainment. I can explain those later. But I'd like us to stay together, and if that's uncomfortable for you, that's fine. Just visualize your own bubble or energy field and fill it up with white light, and then you'll be separate again, which is also great if you're going to work and you can't stand your boss. Yeah. A bubble, fill it with white light. There's no way that boss can get in there. That's protection. So if you don't want to do this, then just fill your bubble with white light. And if you do, please don't clap. What we're going to do when it's over is we're going to do what the hearing impaired do. You know, and we'll keep it quiet that way so nothing gets broken apart. So here we are together on Saturday morning at the ACA convention, which people have been planning for a year. And the work has just turned into the good part. We're all together with the same idea, healing. And we're taking a deep breath in, breathing in relaxation. And then like you have a straw in your mouth, pursed lips, we're slowly blowing out through that straw. So our breathing is slow. Can't hyperventilate this way. We're breathing in relaxation and we're blowing out stress through pursed lips. One more breath. Breathing in relaxation, blowing out stress. Now I'd like you to take your consciousness, your awareness down into your toes. If your feet aren't flat on the floor, if you're sitting, uncross them and put them flat. If you're lying down, just feel your toes and your heels and the ball of your foot. And gently say to that part of your body, releasing stress. Releasing stress. Now breathe down into your feet again. And breathe out stress. Now, as this relaxation response starts going up your legs and you're releasing stress, with your eyes closed in your inner viewing, I want you to view this room filling with white light from higher power. And start breathing in that white light. And breathing out stress. Bring that energy up through your legs into your thighs. Feel your bottom on the chair and ask it to give up all the stress. Release the stress. Release the stress in your groin. Release the stress in your belly. And breathe in more white light. Okay, that energy release now is happening in your chest. It's becoming much easier to breathe. Feel your chest relaxing so that every breath is easy. You don't have to stress yourself to breathe. And this time, when you breathe in this white light, let it flow through your throat down into your shoulders. Bring it down into your elbows. Down into your hands. So that the stress is flowing out through every fingertip.
next time you breathe in, breathe it into your head and your throat. If you need to swallow, swallow. All those muscles in your throat are relaxed now. The stress is gone. All those little muscles around your eyes are relaxing. And all the stress is moving out of your face, and your scalp is loose. Your shoulders are like butter melting in the sun. And now the white light is flowing in through the top of your head, and your body is filled with white light. And your heart is open enough that that white light is coming out through your heart into the room. With every breath, there's white light coming in from the top of your head and moving out through your heart. And the white light is flooding the room. It's surrounding all of us in the same white light. Another name for the white light is love. There's so much white light and love in this room that is pouring through the top of the building. And you can see the white light now flooding the resort, flooding the lake. And now we can see the white light moving through the hills that were scorched and the lots that are rubble now from houses, flooding them all with white light and love. And we're breathing in love and we're breathing it out to Southern California. And this love is expanding to all of California and Mexico and the whole Western United States. It's pouring up into Canada and moving across Canada and moving across the Eastern United States. And this love that we're breathing in and moving out through our heart is covering South America and North America. And now it's expanding across the oceans, moving across all the European and Asian countries, Australia, especially Iraq and Israel and Pakistan, India, China. Till the globe is just completely covered. And we're breathing in the love and we're breathing it out to the world. And it's as though we can see the globe now from a satellite. We can see the whole Western Hemisphere. And we can see the line of the Pacific Ocean on California. And we're moving in a little bit closer now. We can see California and the mountains. We're moving in closer. We can see San Diego, the bay. We can see the resort. We can see this building. And we can move back now into the room, into our bodies, and feel how much more relaxed our bodies are. And breathe in the love, and breathe out the stress. And when we're ready, we can wiggle our toes, come back into our legs, take a deep breath into our belly. And when we're ready, we can open our eyes. How was that?
No clapping. Anybody want to share anything about their experience? Got a hand up over here.
This might be difficult for me to do emotionally because as we moved from this room to the greater environment world, I found myself becoming very emotionally happy. Mm-hmm. Because I never knew there was so much love out there that existed that could come back to me and be spread so far. So,
thank you. Thank you. Isn't it amazing when we get past our minds and just spread love to the world? How easy that is instead of getting caught up in all of these different opinions? Just sending love. Imagine if everybody started just sending love to each other instead of having a political opinion or a global opinion about the war or anything. If we could just realize that this whole world easily could be surrounded in love. It's up to us. And the other thing I want to bring up, did anybody experience the fact that the whole world is alive? The planet Earth is alive? And that the rocks and the trees and the ocean and everything is full of life, full of God, full of higher power? Anybody else want to share?
Yeah.
Wait, let me get over there so we can get this on the CD.
I was in one of those areas where the flames came within 100 yards of our house. Mm-hmm. And thanks to God and things like firefighters and stucco walls and concrete tiles, nothing was damaged. But I've been looking out at the burned hills, and there's still a sense, I can see it, that there's life out there. Mm-hmm. And if we get rain, the green will be back.
Thank you. I used to live in South Florida. Thank you for reminding me. I used to live in South Florida, and we lived right off the Everglades. The Everglades were right behind our house. And the first year we were there, there was this terrible fire in the Everglades. There were no houses, but everything that was, you know, wild was destroyed. And I was heartbroken until my next-door neighbor told me that that's how the seeds spread in the jungles, is through fire. I didn't know that. So there's always something after the fire. And thank you for sharing that. Yeah. I'm getting real close to you, by the way, instead of just handing you this, because we've got another microphone on me. So it goes on the CD. Yeah.
Well, when I started to breathe in, I started to have problems in my throat. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't accept that love that was coming in. Mm-hmm. And this also, I consider the throat my power center. Mm-hmm. I also consider myself not very articulate, and I know that's not true. That's probably the false self. So mm-hmm. I'm working on that with myself right now. So I just felt like maybe that was like a try to clear it, open up, mm-hmm. and to accept that so that I could heal this.
Okay. Good point. I'm inviting anybody who wants to join the two of us after this talk outside, and we'll do three clearing. It's called Ha Screaming, and it comes from Shiatsu. When I was in training to become a Shiatsu therapist, we would do this to clear our throats, where we hold a lot of anger, especially women. We hold our anger right here. We'll go outside, and it's just three blasts, and we can give it to the trees. The trees will be very happy to take it. So meet me outside after, at least you and I and anybody else, male or female, that wants to join us. It's really fun. Did you? Yeah. Being tossed like that, it's an energy block, and I wrote about energy blocks in this book, which is the book that really is covering step by step what I learned about spiritual awakenings. When we've got stuff that's clinging like that, we can dialogue with it to find out what it is. I don't know if you know what it is yet, but we can do creative stuff like writing with our other hand, our non-dominant hand, or just doing some kind of dialoguing to find out what it is that doesn't want to let go. And sometimes it's not going to let go, and sometimes we're going to decide. I can remember years ago in therapy saying to my therapist, I have this broadcast coming from the pit of my being. It's somewhere down in here, and it's the size of a pea, and it's very hard. And it broadcasts up to me that I am a piece of shit. Okay, direct from my parents. And she said to me, you don't want it to go away. I said, what do you mean I don't want it to go away? She says, this is where all your creativity comes from. This is how, when you write, how deep you go, because you've got this deep. And she said, but what we can do is we can turn down the volume.
And she gave me this visual of a radio and just turning down the volume so I didn't have to hear it anymore. Might try that. Whoops. Who else before we get into questions? This, I guess this really is questions. Mary Ellen.
I just wanted to ask you, I've been told that if you have a lot of pain and you don't want to put the pain out into the world, but I was told that if you have a lot of pain, go ahead and let it out, because whatever you let out becomes positive to somebody else. Mm-hmm. It's just releasing energy, and it's releasing your negative energy, and everybody, I mean, the world is experiencing as positive energy.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And I would add to that there is one incredibly powerful prayer when we want to get hooked up, when we have that much pain and we don't know what to do with it. And the prayer is one word. It's help! Help! And I'll tell you, I was sitting on a screened-in porch in Florida a few weeks ago doing my help, and I won't get into why, but it was a family matter and I needed help. And nature, being outside in the evening, three deer walked by where I was sitting. You know, I could have said, oh, you know, they're building up this area so much, the poor wildlife, they have nowhere to go. I didn't look at it that way. When I saw the silhouette of that first deer, my heart was drained of pain. I was okay after that. And for the next week, I have a daughter who's sick, and I was there to help her. For the next week, I just kept thinking of that first deer. And every time I thought of that first deer, the pain just popped right out of my heart, and I was clear. So help, and then give it up to whatever comes along to take it. You know, you can donate your pain to the ocean. You guys live so close. Go to the ocean and just go, here's my pain. Take it away. And the ocean will take it. In our area, it's the trees. We have this beautiful forest in the back of our house, and our patients know that our trees will take their pain. I saw somebody back here. Yeah. Donate it to the ocean, donate it to the trees. But that becomes a spiritual bypass if we don't do our emotional work behind it too. And for somebody who's been trying to, not so much forgive my parents for 32 years, I think because I'm a girl, I think I was more scared of my parents. You know, maybe for guys it's more about the anger, but for me, for sure, and some of my female patients, we're terrified. You know, my mother died in 94. I think it took me 3 years to stop being scared. You know, what if I die and she's waiting for me? Oh, God, I'm going to get it. I'm going to get it this time, boy. So you're walking around with anger. I'm walking around with fear. I define forgiveness as letting myself off the hook, okay? Forgiveness is a long process. It's not a head trip where somebody says to me, you have to forgive. You know, if you're going to be a religious person, you have to forgive. Well, that's fine for them, but not for me, because no matter how many times I forgave, it came back. So I realized it wasn't real. It wasn't grounded in me. But over the years, what I've realized, and one of our group therapy patients used this beautiful visual. She said, it's like there's a hook in them, and there's this cord, and there's a hook in me. And she said, and I'm sick of it, and everybody keeps telling me to forgive them. Well, what I need to do is take the hook out of me and let them deal with their own stuff. And that's how I see it, as far as like getting rid of your anger. Your anger, or my fear, has us so hooked that it really has nothing to do with them. You know, it has to do with what we're carrying around. So especially after having a life review, and we call the life review the cosmic equalizer. I'm going to get into my life review more tonight when I'm talking about humility. But in life review, I had to feel whatever pain I caused anybody else, but at the same time, I got to feel whatever love I caused anybody else, okay? So I knew that my parents, when they died, if they had a life review, were going to have to feel what it was they did to me. However, I can unhook it now, because it's really about me. It's really about what I'm carrying around, and they're going to have to deal with their stuff, and I can't heal them, but I can help heal myself. So the visual with the anger, besides if you want to do some screaming with us after this is over, and that gets it out, anger bat work gets it out, wringing a towel gets it out. There's all kinds of great ways to purge ourselves of our anger. But just the visualization of taking that hook out of ourselves, you know, and make it a vicious-looking hook, because anger and fear are vicious. Yeah. I have been trained. I have my PhD in guilt, right? I have a master's in shame. But my guilt is better than my shame. Because with shame, I just am bad. And I'm just going to walk around being bad for the rest of my life because I'm bad through and through. But with guilt, I've got a reason. I can tell you every reason why I should feel guilty. And what it all comes down to is that somewhere in our childhood, one of our significant, whoever took care of us, taught us that we were the recipient, that we were the container of all things bad. Especially if you look at the family chain, there's a certain child in every family when there's a lot of kids that gets more of it than everybody else. We have been primed so that by the time we are an adult, give me your shame, give me your guilt, I will take it. Oh, it's gone. But the map of the mind, you know, it just pushes us way down into our false self. And it makes that bundle of toxic pain that I was talking about so much bigger. So we talk about it in therapy. We talk about it in 12-step meetings. We write about it. We can write an unmailed letter to the person that we think molded us like this and let them know we're not taking it anymore. We can read it aloud to other people. I do a spiritual ceremony where we take the paper that we've written and we take it outside and we burn it with a little bit of sage or a little bit of pine needles and send it back up to Spirit. And then Spirit can deal with it. Spirit will take care of that person. We don't have to anymore. What we need to do is just get rid of it. Body work helps. Screaming helps. But I also think that it's the moment that we finally say to ourselves, I'm going to learn how to love myself enough that I'm just not going to rap on myself like this anymore. It's just, whatever time I have left on this planet and this incarnation, I want to love myself. I mean, that's what I was being shown in my life review, was the only thing I had done wrong was I hadn't learned how to love myself. Because nobody could show me how to love myself. If my mother couldn't love herself, she couldn't love me. And I had to learn how to love myself. Yeah.
If it's your own guilt, I mean, just crap.
You know, crap.
It's your own crap.
It's my own crap.
Cause or whatever.
Okay. I understand that. If it didn't come from somewhere else, if it's just coming from me or my religion or my education, I mean, there's very subtle ways that society lays guilt on us. It's just making a promise to myself. This is how it worked for me. I don't know if it can work for you, but it was making a promise to myself that I was going to learn how to love myself. I couldn't say I'm going to love myself because I didn't know what love was. I had never been taught love. I knew I loved my kids, but I thought to myself, and I remember this being a prayer, please help me to learn how to love myself as much as I love my kids. Don't I deserve that? Don't I deserve to find out what they're feeling? Because, man, I love them like crazy. Why can't I love myself? And I think that when we learn, when we put ourselves on a path to love ourselves, that's when the guilt has to move over because it has to make room for the love. Okay. Yeah.
Repressed memories.
What about them?
Well, I mean, how do you, I'm not that I want to bring them up, but how do you get through, how do you get through the healing when you can't remember?
I'm going to defer that to Charlie's talk this afternoon. You can ask him. You know, he's got a book called Memory and Abuse.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
good.
Yeah. I don't know if we have any copies of that here.
Two things. One is I don't believe that I can love anything else any more than I can love me, meaning I have to love me first before I can love someone or something else. And the other thing is there's a part of me that's really envious of the people that say they've had a spiritual awakening or a spiritual experience that seems so encompassing like yourself, but you can take it with you wherever you go,
mm-hmm.
because I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my out-of-body experiences have been dissociating
mm-hmm.
For a traumatic event, and it hasn't been looking down on something. In January, I had one where I was behind myself looking, but it was narrow as
mm-hmm.
opposed to seeing everything. So I don't have an experiential thing about
yeah.
what you're talking about.
Okay, great question. There's two parts to it, too, and I had two different answers. I thought about this for a long time before I did this talk, because, please, I do not want you to feel separate from me because I've had this woo-woo experience, you know. I'm you and you're me, as far as I can tell in my own heart. The only difference between me possibly and you is that I know I existed without my body, and I know when I die I'm going to continue existing because I have proof of it. But other than that, I've had to go through the same struggles that all you guys are going through with that bundle of toxic pain. You know, there's no instant cure. What there is I was being shown something that I needed to be shown.
Haven't you been able to take that experience with you and know that there's, like, say, the other side of it, or that you have your higher power, for lack of a better way to put it, so you know you're going to move through it, not making that any less painful.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I know for me, sometimes I don't know that I'm going to get through it because I don't feel necessarily like I have that experience to get through it.
I'm not saying this to be whatever, but my first impulse to say to you is we all get through it.
Yes.
We're all God's children, and we're all going to get through this. But I want to go back to what you said about the out-of-body experience in January and you were behind yourself. Mm-hmm. When I teach meditation and when we talk to our group members about meditating, we always talk about the witness behind us, over on one shoulder, called the observer or the witness, who is watching the chatter that's going on. I mean, meditation's really hard. We're supposed to quiet our mind down and sit there with a flat line. But what I've been able to do over the years, I've been meditating for over 30 years now, is move back to what you just described and let my consciousness sit there. And my consciousness back there is going, tee-hee, look at her sitting there chattering. And I stay back there with her. And whenever anything traumatic is happening, I want to move back and be her. I want to connect with, I think it's my higher self. This could be your higher self. I want to be back here because my body's going to be feeling all the emotion. It's going to be feeling the flight or fight, fight or flight, whatever. You know, our bodies are reacting like crazy. And if we can have what you had in January, that's something that we're all looking for in meditation.
It didn't feel that way.
No, it didn't feel that way because it wasn't reframed. See, that's a lot of what healing is about, is reframing what's going on with us. Did you know that?
Can you explain that?
Reframing? Let's see. I do some reframing in my new book. I have a book coming out, hopefully, next summer called The Natural Soul. Please look for it. reframing. Okay. Thank you very much. No. Oh, I wish you could all see this. Look around. Great.